WNYC Studios is supported by the Brennan Center for Justice, presenting The Failed Experiment of Mass Incarceration. This virtual event on Wednesday, April 17th at 3 p.m. will feature criminal justice advocates and contributors to the new book, Excessive Punishment: How the Justice System Creates Mass Incarceration. They will discuss why the American approach to criminal justice is so punitive and how reforms would prioritize human dignity and restoration over retribution. Find more information and register for this event at brennancenter.org/events.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave, but his soul goes marching on.
Glory, Mike Peskin for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Did you know that before John Brown's body lay a-moldering in the grave, as Pete Seeger there sang, did you know that John Brown's body had a brief stop in New York City? In fact, the date of that layover from the time he was hanged in present-day West Virginia to the time he found his final resting place in North Elba, New York, that was December 4th. That was today in 1859. Let's take the opportunity to look at John Brown's impact, which first really began to be felt in the days leading up to his hanging, as he did interviews, including with a lot of New York newspapers, and it really became a movement that captured the imagination of at least the northern part of the country, and yes, the southern part of the country, too, that they were scared. It wasn't a big New York City story, but I think we're going to turn it into one as best we can with Tony Horowitz, author of Midnight Rising, John Brown and the Raid That Sparked the Civil War. Thanks for joining us, Tony.
Thanks for having me.
So, as I said, and I just got done reading this book, and I did notice that a lot of the action, the abolitionists seemed to be based in New England and Boston. His secret backers were from New England, and then you had the Transcendentalists. There wasn't a huge New York component to his life. He lived in Connecticut. He lived in Kansas. He lived in Ohio. He did live in upstate New York, very close to Canada. But why do you think his story failed to intersect that much with New York of the 1850s?
Well, it intersects with upstate New York quite a bit. That was actually a bastion of abolitionism and a strong source of support for him. But New York City was not. I think we forget that slave-grown cotton wasn't just a southern thing. It was a driver of the national and global economy. It was three-quarters of the nation's exports. And New York City was at the center of that, trading cotton, shipping cotton, insurance, banks, you name it. And so they had strong commercial ties with the South and were by no means enthusiastic about John Brown's program of overthrowing slavery and bringing on a great conflict between North and South.
It's a little like the Civil War, where there were a lot of sympathizers with England because of New York's status as a center of mercantilism. And as you write in the book, what was the figure if the South's economy were counted alone at the time? It would be about the third or fourth biggest in the world?
Yeah, it was a real economic titan. I think because of Gone with the Wind, we know about the wealth, but we imagine it as this sort of, you know, doomed backward society. That wasn't at all the case. Cotton was really the oil of its day. It was this commodity on which the whole world was hooked, and it drove northern textile mills, British textile mills, and many other aspects of the economy.
So if Spielberg wants to do a sequel, to a prequel it would be, to Lincoln, and film your book, right? And he could start with so many scenes. He could start with John Brown and his men slaughtering slave sympathizers in Kansas. He could start at the pre-dawn hours where he actually did take the Harper's Ferry arsenal. He could start with him as he was about to be hanged. But we'll make the weird artistic choice and start with December 4th, where John Brown's body is in New York. What would we have seen?
Yeah, well, John Brown is hanged on December 2nd in Charlestown, Virginia, which is now in West Virginia. And then his body has a long trip north to upstate New York, where he had settled his family near Lake Placid. And this becomes an occasion, really, for veneration. He's become, by this point, a martyr to many in the north. So it's this week-long sort of outpouring of grief and veneration. And on on December 4th, his body arrives in New York City at an undertaker's at 163 Bowery, and it's supposed to be secret that his body is there. It's going to get sort of repackaged for the rest of the journey, but word gets out, and people begin thronging the streets, and they want to see his body. They want to take bits of his coffin, even of his hair. It's like saints' relics.
Yeah, in fact, and you know, you have good footnotes in the book, and I was able to look up the original documentation, which is so cool. It's not because I'm a journalist or historian. Anyone could do this. I'll read from you from the diary of George Templeton Strong. The corpus of old John Brown is in the city at North Something, which, as you said, is 163, in the Bowery. Carpenter, the sexton of St. Mark's, had told George of the fact confidentially. Carpenter had been employed in his undertaking capacity to attend to the putting of the relics of that sainted redemptorist on ice, and George Athen could probably be admitted to the site of the remains. And as you say, they start taking the coffin nails and they start taking hair, and it is a whole to-do. But as you also mentioned, New York wasn't maybe so pro-abolitionist. Was it his actions in the moments from when he was captured to when he was hanged, his, I guess, PR offensive that changed a lot of people's minds?
Yeah, this is, to me, one of the great ironies of John Brown's story. He's a man who believes in action and has contempt for mere speakers and writers. He calls them milk and water abolitionists. But ultimately, he fails in his actions at Harper's Ferry. His raid fails. But he triumphs through the power of his words. It's really his eloquence in court and in prison, condemning slavery, and his courage in going to the gallows that transforms him from this sort of fiery abolitionist that most in the North and South condemn to this hero martyr to many in the North. So, yes, that 5-6 weeks between his capture and his hanging is really the pivotal period in the sort of creation of the legend of John Brown.
Right. And so that's where John Brown's body actually has symbolic importance. And what a detail that struck me in the book is how often the Southerners were taken, and I think this appealed to their sense of manliness, by his comportment, how brave and stout and resolute he was.
Yeah, even his fierce opponents, you know, among them Stonewall Jackson, who watches him hang, and others who hate everything John Brown stands for, are really awed by his courage and his steadfastness. This guy never flinches. He is absolutely staunch from beginning to end. And I think it's really the manner of his dying that gives him such power.
He was very lucky that he wasn't killed, as he didn't run away, and many of his men who were killed did flee or try to escape. So he never did that. But he was quite fortunate because he was involved in firefights where he was only and stabbed repeatedly, but he was they were only glancing blows. But for that, it might not have been the spark of the Civil War that it came to be.
Exactly. If he had died on the floor of what became known as John Brown's Fort, the engine house at Harper's Ferry that became his headquarters, I think we wouldn't be talking about him today. And it's really his rather flukish survival in this very bloody encounter in which most of his men are killed and captured, you know, that he miraculously survives and then is given this pulpit, really, in court and in prison. He turns it into a press conference. That really is the key to his, you know, becoming the hero that he does at the time and the legend that we still talk about today.
John Brown's tactics seem to me fairly awful. How would you assess them militarily?
Yeah, he was a self-taught military or guerrilla commander and had rather peculiar notions about how to undertake his missions, particularly at Harper's Ferry. And I think in military terms, this mission was doomed from the start. He thought with 21 guerrilla fighters, he could seize this massive armory, free and armed slaves, and begin a rolling campaign of liberation across the South. This wasn't, in my view, realistic, but Brown was also really fighting psychological warfare. And in that way, I think he was quite clever and ultimately successful.
Do you believe that he knew that his plan was not a good one?
I think he believed in his plan and in himself, and that he was an agent of God for the destruction of slavery. But I think he also recognized that it was likely that he would be killed at Harper's Ferry. And in his own mind, it was a win-win. Either this rather crazed scheme would succeed, and if it didn't, he would die a martyr in the ruins. He likens himself to Samson at the end, pulling down the pillars of slavery and dying in the ruins of this institution he'd fought so long to destroy. And in that sense, ultimately, he is successful.
Can he be faulted, do you think, for misleading his men, misleading almost all of them to their deaths?
Absolutely. Brown is a very troubling figure, and that's part of what makes him so fascinating to me. I think too often he's been viewed either as a sort of unblemished, you know, martyr by some in the North, and then on the other hand as a sort of, you know, homicidal monster, particularly in the South. And I think he's much more complex than that. He embodies traits that we can greatly admire, his genuine belief in racial equality and the need to fight for it, and on the other hand, be very disturbed by his violent tactics. And as you said, he may have misled his men, even his own sons, and caused or contributed to their death. So, you know, I think we have to accept that this is an uncomfortable figure.
Is there evidence that Lincoln was swayed, his mind was changed at all by John Brown?
Yeah, well, you mentioned the prequel to Lincoln. If I had a complaint about the Lincoln movie, which is wonderful, it's that it doesn't show Lincoln's own change in his views. At the time of John Brown's raid, and really for a couple of years into the Civil War, Lincoln is really a conservative, or at the conservative end of anti-slavery opinion. He doesn't think the North should interfere with slavery in the South, as Brown tried to do. He opposes slavery's expansion, but he doesn't. He's not an abolitionist. He also doesn't believe in racial equality. He believes blacks, once freed, should be colonized in Africa or Latin America because they can never live as equals to whites in this country. And my prequel would begin at Cooper Union in New York, where in 1860, Lincoln makes a speech condemning John Brown and saying that's not what we stand for as Republicans. What's so interesting is that Lincoln's views evolve in the course of the Civil War so that by the end, he is really fulfilling John Brown's mission by emancipating slaves and enlisting black soldiers. And he pays the price as well. John Brown, you could say, is the first martyr of the Civil War, and Lincoln is the last.
Do you think he was a terrorist?
In the sense that terror was his greatest weapon. Again, he used psychological warfare. His actions in Kansas and Virginia and elsewhere were designed to strike terror into the hearts of white Southerners, and that was very effective. I wouldn't call him a terrorist in the way that we've come to understand it today, Islamic militants slaughtering thousands of innocents for murky political ends. Brown did not kill indiscriminately, and he had a clear mission, which was the overthrow of slavery. So I think the meaning of terrorism has changed over the last 15 years or so because of events in our world, in New York in particular.
You know, people look at that picture of John Brown with his beard and his fierce eyes, and more than a few people thought of Osama bin Laden. Some of the comparisons are there. They both had a lot of sons, but of course, Osama bin Laden was extremely rich, and it's very important to John Brown's story that he was extremely poor and barely survived several winters before the raid on Harper's Ferry. But I think the thing why I thought your book was such a great history, and the kinds of histories that I like, which another way of saying this is all good histories, make you think about the present. And maybe it's true that the huge difference between someone like John Brown and a despised terrorist of today is that John Brown's cause was just. I mean, it really, to some extent, comes down to that.
Yeah, I hope we can all agree today that Brown was on the right side of history and believing that slavery was the great cancer of this nation up to that point. Also, he's homegrown. I think we have a tendency to take troubling figures in our history and sort of push them to the margins. Brown was really a classic American in many ways. He had Puritan forebears and was the grandson of Revolutionary War officers, and he felt he was fulfilling America's great destiny of liberty and equality. He wasn't someone acting from a cave, 5,000 miles away. He felt he was the truest American, in a sense, and many ultimately agreed with him.
Here, a quote from another original document. This is called the New York Semi-Weekly Tribune. You'll see the phrase that jumped out at me. A report on bodies in transit, the city inspector's report of John Brown. The following record of John Brown appears on the books. Date of passage, December 4th. Name, John Brown. Age, 59. Place of death, Charleston, Virginia. Then it was Virginia. Disease, hanging.
Yeah. It's quite graphic.
Yeah, it is a fatal disease, yes.
Yeah, does kill you, or it did in this instance. I think in terms of New York City, an interesting thing, getting back to the Lincoln movie, if anyone has seen it, they'll see two New York figures who really present the opposite camps. William Seward, who's played by David Strathairn in the movie and is Lincoln's, advisor and a strong proponent of freeing slaves. And on the other side is Fernando Wood, who's a congressman and previous mayor of New York, who is speaking out strongly against the 13th Amendment. And at the beginning of the Civil War, he even proposed that New York secede from the nation, become a free city, so that it could maintain its bond of commerce with the South. So you really had a very divided scene in New York.
And finally, we started with the John Brown's Body Lies a Moldering in the Grave, which predated Julia Ward Howe, who wrote lyrics that became Battle Hymn of the Republic, published on the front page of The Atlantic. Do you have a favorite line or passage from the Battle Hymn of the Republic, Tony?
I think it's trampling, I'm going to mangle it, trampling out the, with the grapes of wrath are stored.
Trampling through the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored.
Yes. This is militant Christianity. It very much embodies Brown's spirit. He was a Christian warrior. That's how he saw himself, and I think that, in a sense, is what she was writing about. Even though she doesn't name John Brown in the song, it's really infused with his spirit.
Tony Horowitz, author of Midnight Rising, John Brown and the Raid That Sparked the Civil War. Thank you, Tony.
Thanks for having me.
And in a moment, we'll talk about The Sopranos, The Wire, and all those TV shows that are changing our lives.